Above the doors, a gigantic symbol of the Order. The upswept wings, embracing a spear of starlight, shining up and out into the galaxy. Bell didn't love Elfrona. He would have been happier with that Mon Cala posting, for instance, where breezes smelled of sea and life, not rust. But he did love the outpost. It was simple and majestic at the same time. Everything the Jedi should be. It was dawn, and the rising sunlight caught the electrum of the Jedi symbol, setting it alight with reflected fire. The view from the clifftop where he stood could not be improved. It was perfection. Bell Zedifar, Jedi Padawan, soaked it in. Then he began to turn around, intending to tell his master, Jedi Knight Loden Greatstorm, that he was not ready for this particular exercise today, and wanted to read up on the techniques a bit more before he just jumped off a perfectly good cliff.
"I believe in you,"
he heard Loden say from a few meters behind him. Bell felt his master reach out to the Force, and then something like a hand in the center of his back. And then he was shoved hard, right off the cliff. Some 30 kilometers away was the settlement of Ogden's Hope, a fairly large town built and maintained on the dreams of those who thought they might be able to transform the planet's mineral wealth into a fortune of their own. The mining industry on Elfrona was over a century old, but the planet's governments over the decades had successfully resisted the efforts of the huge galactic concerns to buy up and consolidate its resources. The entire planet was divided into a grid, and no one family, corporation, enterprise, or association was allowed to own more than 4 claims at a time. That meant much of the planet remained unclaimed, and who knew what treasures might be waiting under the surface, ready to be discovered. Earlier strikes had turned up rare minerals, orodium and platinum, even stranger substances, a vein of crystals once. Elfrona was a planet-sized treasure vault, and somehow, it belonged to everyone who lived there. Ogden's Hope, as a place, was well-named. It was a place of possibility, where everyone had an equal chance at success and freedom. Chancellor Lena So cited Elfrona often in her speeches, as emblematic of the spirit of the Republic. It was a hard place, but generally a good one. To this good place, a family had come, from a populous, wealthy world in the core. A mother, a father, a son, and a daughter. They acquired 2 claims next to each other, an hour's speeder ride from Ogden's Hope. Longer if you ran into a rust storm. They built themselves a place to live, with the help of their droids. The first version was just a rough, ugly structure of permacrete. Nothing more than a shelter from the sun and wind. But in time, it had become theirs. More rooms, more windows, a greenhouse, a second story, decoration, all the little touches that transformed housing into home. They dug into the soil, looking for whatever treasures might be beneath their feet. The family could have used their droids to do most of the work, but that was not why they had come to Elfrona. And so they all did their part. The children studied with their droid tutors and grew taller every day. The parents worked and planned and believed they had made the right decision for themselves and their family. Until one early morning, the mother, whose name was Erica, looked up from a delving droid she was repairing to see a strange cloud not far from their home. It was odd. Unlike anything she had ever seen. For one thing, it hugged the ground like a fog bank. But Elfrona was a dry world. There was water, but it circulated deep below the surface in underground rivers and channels. Rain was a once-per-decade event. So fog? No, it couldn't be. Even beyond that, this cloud looked odd. It had a sheen to it. Like a metallic blue, like A storm cloud, really. Though she hadn't seen one of those since she left her homeworld some years back. And it seemed to be moving with direction, or purpose, toward them.
Otto?
She called to her husband, who was not far away, spreading feed for their small herd of steelies. The long-legged beasts were clustering around the trough, their excitement at getting their morning meal obvious.
What do you suppose that is?
Otto turned to look. He froze. Unlike his wife, he kept up with galactic affairs. He had not entirely cut himself off from the news of the Republic, and so he had heard stories and knew what it meant when a storm came creeping toward your home or business or family.
Get B, he said, dropping the sack of feed he was holding. I'll find Ron. We need to get in the house and seal it up, now!
Erica didn't ask questions. She didn't hesitate. They were many kilometers from help, and even a good world in the Outer Rim territories was full of danger. She called for her daughter and ran to the house.
Ron!
Otto shouted, not taking his eyes off the cloud.
Get in the house, right now!
Within the approaching fog, figures were beginning to become visible. 10 or so. He couldn't make out details yet, but he knew who they were. He had heard the stories of impossibly vicious marauders who appeared from nowhere and left the same way, leaving nothing in their wake but terror that they would return. The Nihil. Bell reached out to the Force. He knew that as a Jedi, he could survive this fall. He had seen Loden do similar things many times in the past, most recently on Hetzel Prime, but in training, too. Loden could drop like a rock and then slow himself at the last moment for a perfect landing. It wasn't flying. No Jedi born without wings could fly, as far as Bell knew. But it also was not exactly falling. Bell knew it could be done, and he knew Loden Greatstorm believed he could do it. His master, probably, would not have used the Force to shove him off that obscenely high cliff otherwise. Bell thought the Jedi Council would frown on inadvertent Padawan murder. But he also thought Loden could talk his way out of it, probably by arguing that the Order had no use for a Padawan who couldn't master something as simple as a controlled descent. All of this flashed through Bell's head in the merest second after his plummet began. With a massive effort, he forced himself to focus, to find the flame of the Force within and fan it into greater life, and through it, connect with the air currents rushing past his face and whipping through his dreadlocks. Loden had given him instruction on how to execute this maneuver safely, though he was frustratingly vague in his description of how it was supposed to work. In general, the idea was to guide yourself to the updrafts and use them as a foundation to slow your fall. Once you figured that out, you were somehow also supposed to use the Force to push against the ground as it drew closer. The two elements could slow you down enough to land safely. Bell had achieved it easily enough in temple training when falling from lesser heights, or if dropping onto a repulsor pad that would prevent any real injury. But now, when plummeting from a cliff, facing a horrendous maiming, if he was lucky, he could barely even remember what Loden had told him to do. He knew the real challenge here was not mastery of the Force, but mastery of fear, always the Jedi's greatest test. A test he was about to fail. And from this height, he knew even Loden Greatstorm could not catch him.
This was it. The end.
Bell closed his eyes. The fear rushed in, and he didn't even fight it. He asked for serenity and hoped he would just die quickly and not be left in broken agony on the jagged iron rocks at the base of the cliff. The wind stopped rushing past him. Bell opened his eyes and saw the ground a meter or so below him.
Then he dropped, hitting hard, though not as hard as he would have if his fall had not been stopped. He rolled over, groaning, and a shadow fell across him.
You need to figure this out,
Indira Stokes said.
Loden really is going to kill you one of these times.
She extended a hand, and Bell took it and let the other Jedi pull him up. Indira was Tholothian, with dark skin, only a few shades lighter than Bell's own, elegant white tendrils in lieu of hair, and eyes so blue they almost seemed to glow, just like every member of her species Bell had ever met. Her leathers were scratched and worn, with the Jedi insignia in white on one shoulder. She wore her lightsaber holster on a strap of yellow webbing slung diagonally across her chest, and kept a dark gray nanofoil scarf wrapped around her neck, useful as a mask in dust storms, and moldable into almost any shape she might need. Standing at Indira's side was a small four-legged creature, mostly mottled black, white, and gray, but with spots of red and orange here and there, and bright yellow eyes. A Charhound, native to Elfrona. She took a few steps forward and nuzzled at Bell's hand. He scratched behind her ears, and the little beast purred with pleasure.
Hi, Ember, Bell said. Nice to see you too.
He gave the Charhound one last scratch and looked back at Indira.
Did Loden ask you to catch me?
He said, brushing dust off his own leathers, originally bright white, but now well worn in, stained and mottled, evidence of hard use.
Yep, Indira said. No shame in it. No Jedi is perfect at everything from the start.
She held out his lightsaber hilt. He hadn't even felt it fall from his side. Bell took it and slipped it into his own holster, worn at his hip.
No shame, he said.
Loden knew he'd fail from the beginning.
I just don't get why he won't let it go, he said. I clearly can't do this.
Because one day you'll fall off a cliff for real, and he wouldn't be doing his job if he didn't try to keep you from dying when you do. Jedi fall off things a lot. You need to be ready.
Indira turned toward the path that led back up toward the outpost.
Come on, she said. Porter is making breakfast. 9 eggs, too. And he told me he found some stone peppers, too.
You think Loden will let me eat before he throws me off the cliff again?
Bell said.
I'll insist, she said. No one should die on an empty stomach.
Wow, Bell said. So kind of you.
He followed her up the path, Ember keeping pace at his side. Otto lifted the single-lens ocular and set it against his eye. The device had a setting that allowed him to see through walls to pick up heat signatures from outside. Good, because the Nihil had already killed their homestead security cams. The monitors in the safe room were just throwing out static. Now, not all the parts of the fancy security system they'd had installed when they moved out to the claim had failed. The automated reinforced Durasteel shutters had worked as promised, slamming down over doors and windows as soon as the family was safely inside. But without the cams, they were almost blind. All Otto had was the ocular and the rough outlines it provided on its infrared setting. The Nihil showed up as purple and red outlines, with strange, misshapen heads. Otto had seen hundreds of different alien species in his day, but he'd never seen anything like the Nihil. It made him think they were probably wearing masks, which aligned with both the stories he'd heard and the fact that they used gas to hide their movements and incapacitate their prey. But knowing that didn't make them any less threatening. They were monsters, looming up from nowhere. The gas was definitely still out there, too, even if the ocular couldn't pick it up. The family's herd of Steelies were all lying on their sides in their pen, unconscious or dead, and as far as he knew, nothing had touched them.
Will the seals keep out the gas?
Erica said, evidently thinking along the same lines.
That's what the company promised. The safe room's supposed to be impervious to all but the highest levels of blaster fire and impermeable to chemical and radiological weapons.
You didn't say explosives, his wife said. What if they brought explosives?
Otto didn't answer.
Well, whatever they brought,
I'm ready to fight, she said,
and he set down the ocular and looked over at her. Erica tapped her datapad one final time, then held it up for Otto to see, displaying the elements of the plan she had come up with.
I think the speeder, right?
Yeah, Otto said. At the very least, it'll buy us time. Maybe someone will see the explosion, or maybe the Nihil will just leave.
Now it was his wife's turn to stay silent.
Any luck, Ron?
He called to his son, 13 years old, with everything that came with that age. But now, no angst, no pushback, just doing exactly what he was asked to do in an effort to keep his family alive. Ron was using the family's comlink, trying to reach someone in Ogden's Hope who might be able to help. Their daughter Bee, 9, was curled up against him for comfort, holding a stuffed viractal toy she hadn't touched for years, as far as Otto knew.
I can't get a signal through, Dad. I checked the weather, and there's a big rust storm between us and Ogden's Hope. It's messing with the transmissions, I think.
Keep trying, son, Otto said. Your mother is going to buy us some time.
A huge boom from below. Not an explosion, but the sound of metal on metal. Otto looked through the ocular again to see that a cluster of 4 Nihil had gathered around the front door to the house. They were positioned as if they were holding something, all 4 gripping it together. But the ocular's heat setting couldn't pick out the object. A battering ram made of cold durasteel, he guessed.
They're trying to break down the door, Otto said. Another boom. Now, Erica, Otto said.
His wife pressed a control on her datapad. Outside, Otto could see their 4 delving droids coming up out of sleep mode in the droid pen not far from the main house. Their outlines through the ocular were green and yellow. They put out a different kind of heat than the Nihil, but all were clearly visible. The machines left the pen and moved quickly, accelerating through the yard. The delving droids were industrial machines, loud and powerful, designed to punch holes into hard ground and remove the resulting rubble. There was no way for them to move stealthily, even though the gas presumably still circulating outside probably gave them a little cover. The quartet of droids split, 2 heading for the group at the front door, and the rest toward the speeder. Otto took a moment to appreciate the skill in what his wife was doing, simultaneously overriding the autonomous functions of 4 droids, taking control and making them operate in ways they were not designed to work, running them fast, guiding them via feeds from their monitor circuits on a tiny datapad display. All that complexity to manage, and each droid was moving in a straight line, unerring, right toward their targets.
Good, Erica! You're doing it!
Don't talk to me right now, she said,
her voice tight with concentration. Blaster bolts, hot white through the ocular, began zipping out from both sets of Nihil. The 4 at the front door, and another 6 clustered around their speeder. The raiders had noticed the approaching droids. No surprise there. The machines were tough, built to withstand high impacts and temperatures, but they weren't impervious. One of the droids stopped moving, then another.
Faster, Erica! They're knocking them down!
His wife didn't answer, just flicked him a momentary glance. Otto understood. She was running the droids from her datapad. She knew when they became inoperative right away. She didn't need his updates. He knew that. He'd noted when he spoke. He just wanted to do something. From behind him, he heard his son's voice, talking quickly, and Otto realized he'd actually gotten someone on the comlink. Ogden's Hope maintained a small communal security force, all the claims paid into its budget every year. Their station wasn't so far away. If the family could just hold on a bit longer... A 3rd droid stopped in its tracks, hot green sparks shooting from where its head had once been attached to its neck. Just 1 droid left, and Otto watched as the machine barreled forward. He saw it dodge a Nihil shot, and again marveled at his wife's skill. What operator could make a delving droid dodge? The one he was married to, apparently. The last droid took a hit, dead center, and its speed slowed to a crawl.
Blast it, his wife said. Is that it? Otto said. No, Erica answered, her voice cold and certain. It's not.
Otto heard his wife's fingertips tapping furiously on the datapad, and whatever rerouting and adjustments she did seemed to work. The last droid lurched forward, careening ahead at a rapidly increasing rate of speed. The Nihil weren't done shooting, but the droid seemed all but impervious. It lost an arm, then another. Half its head disappeared, but it didn't stop. It reached the Nihil speeder, and Otto yanked his eye from the ocular just before the lens flared white. A huge sound from outside. Not a boom, but a boom. This time, definitely an explosion. The delving droids were mining machines. Sometimes they dug, sometimes they sorted, sometimes they lugged debris, and sometimes they blasted holes in dense metallic rock with small pellets of high-powered explosive. From the sound, Erica had just set off every bit of the droid's load at once.
Hmm,
his wife said, her tone satisfied.
How many did I get, dear?
Otto raised the ocular to his eyes and looked outside. The scene was radically altered. The Nihil's speeder was gone, as was the delving droid, both replaced by hot, twisted metal and leaping flames. He turned down the brightness, looking for... Ah, there. He counted outlines. Four, close to the fire, and none of them moving. But two others were still alive, one slowly dragging himself away from the wreckage, and another being pulled free by the team that had been using the battering ram at the front door. That group, unfortunately, had been mostly sheltered from the blast by the house.
Not enough, Otto said. But it helps.
He lowered the ocular and turned to his son, who was speaking to B in a low, kind voice.
Did you get someone, Ron?
Otto said.
I heard you on the comlink. Is help coming?
Ron looked up. His face was bleak.
I got through to Ogden's Hope Security, Dad, he said. I told them what was happening. The man on the other end was asking a lot of questions, but he stopped when I told him the Nihil were here. He said they're too far away to get here in time. The man said he was sorry, but he just sounded like he was afraid. I've tried calling back, but they won't answer. Cowards!
Erica spat. From below, a sound, a thud of something heavy hitting their front door, and then a voice.
You shouldn't have done that,
it called, floating up from outside, low and strange.
We were just going to take you.
Thud.
Now, we're going to hurt you too.
You want more stew?
Porter Engel said, looking down into Bell's empty bowl.
Falling's hungry work, I guess.
Across the table, Loden chuckled. Bell didn't care. He was over it. He'd figure out the Force falling eventually. And even if he didn't, that was no reason to turn down a second bowl of Porter's 9-egg stew. Porter Engel was a legend. He'd been in the Jedi Order for over 300 years. A burly Ikruki, who, at this point, was more beard than being. He'd explored full careers in most of the primary Jedi roles in his time. Teacher, explorer, diplomat, warrior. And the stories told about him in any one of those occupations would be enough to ensure his status in the Chronicles. He had just one eye, for example. The other lost long ago. A long scar down his face, a story of its own. But now, he was nearing the end of his span, and his latest and final calling seemed to be cook. The stew really did have 9 different kinds of egg in it, but Porter would only reveal 5 of them. The remaining sources were either too rare or too revolting for him to divulge. Whatever was in it,
The stuff was good.
Below the table, Bell felt Ember stir. She was lying across his boots, her internal heat warm and prominent even through the thick leather. The Hound was no fool. Of all the Jedi of Elfrona, Bell Zedifar was by far the most likely to slip her a bite or two during meals. The creature had appeared one day at the building's entrance, skinny, trembling, and with an infected wound on her rear haunch. Indira treated her injury. Porter fed her. Bell named her, and Loden had allowed her to stay, declaring that the Force had brought them a new member of the team. That was a neat workaround to the Order's rule against forming attachments, because, of course, you were supposed to take care of your fellow team members and make sure they were safe and happy and well-fed and their coat was brushed and, well, the Jedi of the Elfrona outpost had all become extremely fond of Ember the Charhound, rule or no rule.
"Yes, please," Bell said, holding up his bowl. "It's fantastic today."
"It's the stone peppers,"
Porter said, pleased, ladling up another serving of the thick yellow stew.
"Found some nice hard ones at the market."
Veteran Jedi could live wherever they liked, once the passage of time naturally reduced their ability and desire to participate in the more active work of the Order. Most remained at the Coruscant Temple, which maintained lodgings for all its older members to live out their days as they pleased. Porter Engel had taken the opposite approach, actually requesting an assignment to the Elfrona outpost. He seemed intent on remaining as useful as possible despite his age, and an outpost was the best way he knew to ensure his 3 centuries of Jedi experience could directly help the galaxy. In an average day, an outpost Jedi might be called upon to settle a dispute, defend a town from marauders, bring criminals to justice, teach children, offer medical assistance, or just wield the Force in any of the 10,000 ways it could be used to help people. Not every problem required a Jedi to solve it, but when a problem did rise to that level, people tended to be glad they lived on an outpost world.
"Starlight beacon's almost ready for the dedication," Loden said, as Bell dug into his second bowl of stew.
"Just a few weeks," Indira said. "But the Chancellor's hyperspace closures might push that back."
"I hope not,"
Porter Engel said, taking a seat at the head of the table.
"It wouldn't be the end of the world if it didn't open on time. But I know it's important to the Chancellor's future plans that everything runs smoothly. I'd like to see it, too. It sounds beautiful."
"It is," Loden agreed. "Wouldn't you say, Bell?"
"Gorgeous," Bell said. "There's a biosphere zone where visitors can check out actual recreations of various worlds in the Outer Rim territories. Dantooine jungle, an ice flat from Mygeeto. I liked it."
Loden dropped his spoon into his empty bowl.
"The idea is to showcase the diversity of the worlds out here," he said. "They'll rotate the biospheres from time to time, bring in different creatures." "It's very ambitious."
Indira spoke, not looking up from the datapad she was perusing.
"The whole station is ambitious. And it's just the first of many, right? The Chancellor's got a whole network of beacons planned, I think. I read about it."
"That's what they told us at the Conclave," Bell answered.
"Lena So and her great works,"
Porter Engel said.
"I think she's fantastic. If there was ever a time for beacons and relay networks and outreach, it's now. I remember when the galaxy was just pulling itself together a few centuries back. We couldn't think about anything but survival, really. We should use this time of prosperity to build something meaningful for the future."
"Do you think the Order's outpost network will close down once the beacons all come online?" Bell asked.
"I hope not,"
Porter said, leaning back and putting his hands behind his head.
"This sort of life suits me just fine. Every day is a little different. seeing what comes, helping people however they need it. Not so bad.
He signaled a servitor droid, which trundled over and began clearing the breakfast dishes. They were sitting in the outpost dining chamber, a comfortable, low-ceilinged room, one of eight set just off the main chamber. A tall, circular area designed around a huge Jedi Order symbol inlaid on the floor. Sleeping chambers, the kitchen, storage, the hangar, a sparring room for lightsaber training, all of it accessible from the central zone, just as the Force touched all things equally.
Speaking of which, Porter went on, what do you all have on deck for the day?
I'm going to take one of the Vectors to a spot down in the southern hemisphere, Indira said. Some miners think they found a vein of Esurtanium. I've never actually seen it before. Supposed to have really rare properties, maybe even a little Force reactive. I was hoping to buy a sample, bring it back here so I could study it.
Take Bell with you, Loden said.
What, so she can throw me out of the cockpit? Bell said.
You are very wise, my Padawan, Loden said.
Well, I'm going to wash the dishes, Porter said. What about you, Loden?
A claim to the north is having trouble with a nest of Cromonts. I thought I'd go give them a hand.
Can't they just bring in an extermination unit? Indira asked.
Probably, Loden said. But maybe I want to fight 100 Cromonts.
Bell shook his head. He also wanted to fight 100 Cromonts, but he knew better than to ask. He was jumping out of another Vector, and that was that.
A low whistle from the central chamber, and all four Jedi turned their heads toward the sound. The signal for an incoming transmission on the outpost's emergency comm system. Loden reached out and tapped a control set into the tabletop, bringing the transmission into the room. A voice sounded quiet, filled with tension.
Jedi, this is... No, don't want to get involved. But there's a homesteader family about 30 kilometers to the southwest of town. Two parents, two kids. The Blythes. I caught a transmission to the Ogden's Hope security station. I monitor that channel on my comlink like a hobby. Anyway, they were calling for help. The family's being attacked by the Nihil. Ogden's Hope security won't go. Afraid, I think. I'd be afraid, too. The stories we hear about the Nihil. But the person who called in, it was a kid. It sounded really bad. Maybe you could go out there. Help somehow. I'm sending the coordinates. I can't get involved. Not with the Nihil. But I just thought you should know.
The message ended. Ember sensed the tension in the room. From below the table, she coughed out one small sound, like a boot stepping on a piece of charcoal.
The Nihil, Indira said.
The family,
Porter Engel said. His voice had gone very cold. Perhaps for the first time, Bell looked at the man and no longer saw the joking, bearded, crucky chef he knew so well, inventor of the nine-egg stew. Instead, he saw the Jedi they once called the Blade of Bardota.
Let's go, Loden said.
Chapter 23, The Mid-Rim, Naboo. Avar Kriss leaned on the ornate carved stone railing and looked out across the lake to a small, forested island rising to a low peak in its center. A small settlement of low, orange, shingled buildings crouched together by the lakeshore. But otherwise, the island looked like pristine wilderness.
Barrakino, Elzar Mann said, stepping up beside her.
She glanced at him. He looked good. Happy. His dark eyes shining. A grin lighting up his face, though that could be due to the drink in his hand,
some green stuff in a stemless glass bowl. She didn't know what it was, but she knew Elzar, and so odds were it was the finest intoxicant their hosts had available. And considering their hosts, that meant it was probably very fine indeed.
"Very what?" she asked.
"Varakino," he said, gesturing with his drink toward the island. "That's the name of the island. It's an artist's retreat, a place for creative outcasts to live together and think deep thoughts. There's a poet there, a man named Omar Barenko, supposed to be brilliant." Elzar glanced at her. He ran a hand through his dark hair, cut short, with a natural wave to it. "Sounds nice, actually," he said. "We should remember it, once we're too old for the Order to make use of us anymore. I wouldn't mind spending my days in quiet contemplation. Maybe figure out how to catch fish with the Force." He took a sip of his drink, and his face took on an impressed expression. "Oh, as long as we lay in steady supply of this stuff, by the light, that's good."
"Let me try," Eivor said, and he handed her the bowl.
She sipped the liquor, a spicy, soft taste that left her tongue tingling.
"Oof, no arguments here," she said. "That's delicious. But go easy. We're here to do a job."
Elzar had one last swallow, then set the bowl down on the railing. A shining golden servitor droid promptly scooped it up and quietly withdrew, hovering not far away in case the two Jedi required anything further.
"Are your owners on the way?"
Eivor asked the droid.
"We've been waiting for some time."
"Of course, Master Jedi,"
the droid replied in a lovely chime of a voice.
"Masters Mardo and Velis are completing some urgent business, but have notified me that they will be here momentarily. If you wish, you may take a seat while you wait."
The droid gestured with one long, languid limb toward a seating area deeper in the lanai. Plush couches and seats with various refreshments laid out on a low quartz table. She assumed this was where Elzar had gotten his drink.
So much wealth on display here.
Just owning an estate in the Naboo Lake Country was out of reach for any but the richest families in the galaxy. Nonetheless, the feeling created by the decor was not one of ostentation, but of care and taste. The owners of this home were not trying to overawe. Every choice was made with an eye towards simplicity and integration with the natural environment, which, of course, was impressive in its own right. As if to underscore the point, a gentle breeze blew across the patio, rippling through the milliflowers dangling from vines hanging from the arbors overhead. Their fragrance saturated Eivor's senses, and the song of the Force swelled with the beauty of it all. It was easy to forget they were there to continue the investigation into the ongoing galactic emergency. She forced herself to focus. Quiet contemplation could wait for retirement, and for a moment, just one, she let herself consider the idea of spending that time with Elzar Mann. Something she would never tell him. He would never let her hear the end of it. Another emergence, another tragedy, had happened in the Ringlight system, and several thousand people had died. Only the valiant efforts of the system's security squads had prevented something worse. Chancellor So had widened the hyperspace cordon once again. Senator Noir hadn't protested this action. The necessity was obvious. But the pressure was mounting to solve the mystery once and for all. This meeting today could be the key. As if they had read her mind, two men appeared at the edge of the patio and walked toward her and Elzar. Marlo and Velis, the scion of the Santeca Empire and his husband. Both were pale, with blonde hair and blue eyes. The similarities stopped there. Velis's face looked chopped from granite, while Marlo's features were softer. They did seem a pair, though, and like their home, everything about them radiated wealth and comfort and ease.
She wondered what Marlowe's ancestors would think of what the family had become. The Santeca family made its fortune a century or so ago as hyperspace prospectors, rough-edged people finding routes through the wild spaces of the galaxy, like planetary explorers searching for passes through deadly mountain ranges. Hyperspace prospecting was just as dangerous. Many who tried it ended up lost forever, adrift in nothingness, with no way to get home. The Santecas seemed to have a knack for it, though, and consistently found the shortest, fastest ways to get from here to there in the galaxy. They sold those routes to traders, governments, and entrepreneurs, and in some cases set up hyperspace toll lanes where navigational data could be downloaded for a fee. All that revenue added up. These days, the Santecas were among the wealthiest families in the galaxy, and their teams of prospectors, now called hyper-surveyors to give the trade a sheen of respectability, continued to sniff out lucrative new paths between the stars. The galaxy was endless, and people would always want to traverse it more quickly and safely. "Welcome to our home," Marlowe said, extending a hand to Eivor.
"It is an honor to have Jedi guests."
She took the hand and shook it briefly. Elzar did the same with Velis.
"Please, let's sit," Velis said, gesturing to the couch. "The servitor droid tells me you've already sampled the attar of spin silk, one of my favorites as well. But there's much more you can try. Anything you like."
"Thank you,"
Eivor said. The group sat, and Eivor gently reached out with the Force to sense the emotional state of their hosts. They were utterly relaxed. Not that she expected anything else. A gorgeous lakeside patio with the love of your life at your side, and enough credits for 1,000 lifetimes? Of course the Santecas were relaxed.
"Senator Nowar told us you're investigating the dreadful disasters in the Outer Rim,"
Marlowe said, pouring a glass of something red and handing it to Velis.
"I'm not sure what we can do to help, but of course we're more than happy. Izzet is an old friend, and we know he has responsibility for the Outer Rim. Anything he needs, really."
"Not to mention all the people in the firing line," Elzar said, a slight edge to his voice.
"Of course," Velis said. "We are all the Republic."
"The emergencies are bad enough.
And we're working on a system to predict where they're going to happen next,"
Eivor said.
"Oh, really? That's interesting," Marlowe said. "How is that possible?"
"Hetzal Prime happened to have a genius system analyst in their technology ministry. He's trying to build a network of Navidroids, linking their processors together to use the data we have so far about the original disaster and all the emergencies. It's not a sure thing. The problem seems to be getting enough droids to run the calculations."
Marlowe and Velis exchanged a quick glance. Information passed between them. Some unseen communication even Eivor couldn't detect.
"We can probably help with that," Velis said. "We have a proprietary set of algorithms we use to model likely hyperspace routes. If your analyst on Hetzal is interested, we can send a few of our navulators, hyperlane specialists, to help him refine his system. Generally, we like to keep our trade secrets confidential," Marlowe added.
"But there are lives on the line."
"Thank you very much," Eivor said. "That's generous. We'll put you in touch with the analyst. His name is Kaven Tarr. I'm sure he'll take any help he can get."
"That's not really why we're here, though," Elzar said.
"Oh?"
Marlowe said, raising a thin eyebrow. "It's not just about stopping the emergencies. We want to make sure nothing like the Legacy Run ever happens again. And in order to do that, we need to know what caused it. Your family knows more about hyperspace than anyone. Or so Senator Nowar tells us. Do you have any theories?"
"Well, We've read the HollowNet reports, but they are a little light on details. Do you have any additional information?
Elzar reached into his tunic and produced a data chip, which he handed to Velis.
That's everything we have so far. The Republic Transport Bureau's personnel have analyzed the wreckage, and based on the wear patterns, it looks very much like the Legacy Run disintegrated in transit.
A collision?
Marlowe said.
No,
Avar said.
It seems that the ship attempted to execute a maneuver that stressed its superstructure beyond its capabilities. I'm oversimplifying, but it seems to have ripped itself apart.
Velis and Marlowe were silent for a moment. Velis set his glass down. Avar didn't think he'd even tasted his drink.
I'm sure you both know this, but the nature of hyperspace means that there is never any reason to maneuver at all. It's empty. There's nothing to hit. Routes are precisely calculated to ensure collisions like this are impossible.
We know that, Elzar said. Everyone knows that. But something happened out there, and people continue to die and suffer across the Outer Rim. Pretending it's impossible just wastes time.
He pointed at the data chip Velis was still holding.
We're examining a few possibilities. It's all on the chip. Our first thought was pilot error, but we looked into that. The captain of the Legacy Run was a woman named Hedda Cassett. Ex-military, a decorated veteran. It's hard to imagine she would make a mistake that would result in the destruction of her ship. By all accounts, she was steady and focused.
A mutiny?
Marlowe asked.
Why?
Avar replied.
It was a ship full of settlers. A routine run from the core to the Outer Rim territories. Nothing unusual or extremely valuable aboard.
Strange things can happen psychologically when you're out in deep space,
Marlowe said.
We have stories from our family's history you wouldn't believe. Madness creeps in before you know it.
Fair,
Elzar said.
But this was a straightforward run on a well-traveled route. RTB officials interviewed some of the survivors we rescued, and they didn't suggest anything along those lines. Mutiny's low on the list.
Maybe the ship malfunctioned,
Velis ventured.
Not impossible, but unlikely,
Avar continued.
The Legacy Run was an old vessel, but we know from its maintenance records that Captain Cassett kept it in top condition, and it had a full overhaul 2 runs before the trip that killed it.
Our working theory is that it encountered something in the hyperspace lane, and it tried to avoid running into it,
Elzar broke in.
Impossible,
Marlowe said.
I just told you, hyperspace doesn't work that way.
Avar caught a flicker of an impulse from Elzar. Not a word, not a message, but something she understood all the same.
She had known Elzar Mann for a very long time. They were younglings together, and Padawans, and that created a connection, a bond through the Force, that meant sometimes they didn't have to use words to understand each other. But if Elzar had used words, she knew what she was sensing from him would mean he's lying. Elzar was better at sensing deception than she was. Now, when it came to her particular gift, a native understanding of the way the Force touched all life in the galaxy, she thought there might not be a more skilled Jedi in the Order than herself. Well, perhaps Master Yoda. But as far as understanding people, Elzar Mann was an expert. She didn't think he even needed to use the Force to do it. Avar suspected he was considering a use of the Force right then, however. What most Jedi called the mind touch, and he called the mind trick. He found it a more honest way to describe what was actually being done. Elzar would lift 2 fingers in a subtle gesture and touch Marlowe Santeca's mind with the Force. And then Marlowe would do whatever Elzar said next. The mind touch was a tool of the light, Avar knew, but she preferred indirect approaches to such a focused intervention in another person's path. Elzar had his reservations as well, but viewed the technique as a way to open people to the truth, to provide clarity, to allow them to feel the will of the Force. To put it another way, he was a problem solver, and the mind touch certainly solved problems. Eivor sent an impulse of her own across their link, one he would recognize immediately, simple and straightforward.
No.
Elzar turned and looked at her, his face expressionless, but easy for her to read. His mouth quirked up into a quick little smile.
Okay, you got me.
And then he looked back at the Santecas.
Are you absolutely certain a collision is impossible, Velis? Eivor asked. Perhaps a derelict ship or an asteroid? Surely there must be a way for an object to be left adrift in the hyperspace lanes.
Velis shook his head.
Hyperspace is not like real space. Once a ship or anything else enters it, there's no way to encounter anything. You're in a bubble of space-time that nothing else can interact with, because each lane is, as far as we can tell, its own distinct plane of existence.
Eivor knew she would remember those words every time she traveled in hyperspace for the rest of her life. A jump to light speed had become such a routine event, but each time it happened was a step away from everything familiar. A journey into a new universe, some new realm. The song of the Force was beautiful, but sometimes its indescribable vastness left her feeling insignificant. Despite all her focus, all her training, it could leave her reeling. Another impulse from Elzar,
lying.
And again from her,
no. Be that as it may,
Eivor said,
the Legacy Run died, along with many people aboard it, and millions have died since in the emergencies. Your family has spent more time studying hyperspace than anyone in the galaxy. Have you ever encountered anything like this?
No,
Marlowe said flatly, and this time there was no signal of falsehood from Elzar.
So you don't think it's a problem with hyperspace? Elzar said.
We'll look at your data,
Velis said, holding up the data chip.
But as of now, it's hard to imagine something like that. I don't think you have to worry about another legacy run. Our guess, based on more than a century of experience out there in the lanes...
This was a one-time event, Marlowe finished.
Eivor stood up, and Elzar, masking his surprise, did the same.
Thank you,
she said.
We can't tell you how much we appreciate your sending your people to help Kevan Tar and Hetzal. We're going to move on to our next appointment, but if we think of additional questions... Can we reach out?
Of course,
Marlowe said, standing as well.
As we said, it's an honor and a privilege to assist the Jedi and the Republic with anything you might need.
Final pleasantries were exchanged, and Eivor and Elzar left the Santeca compound, heading for the long beam that had brought them to Naboo, waiting on a landing pad just outside the gates.
They were hiding something, Elzar said.
His tone was light, but she knew he was frustrated. A familiar emotion from him. He was always reaching, pushing.
I'm sure they were, Elzar. They're business people. We don't know that what they held back is even relevant. The Santecas didn't seem malicious. The opposite, really. They're offering to share some of their most closely held secrets to help save lives.
Elzar was silent, but she felt a grudging acceptance from him.
Let's continue our investigation. See if there's more we can learn. If need be, we can return and question them again. We made progress here. Be pleased.
The drink was good at least, Elzar said, and walked ahead toward the waiting long beam.
The breeze blew across the lanai, and Marlowe and Velis Santeca sat in silence, looking out across the lake at the Isle of Verrichino, where strange geniuses toiled in isolation, creating art that, more likely than not, would never be seen by anyone beyond the shores of the little island.
You know who this sounds like, don't you?
Velis said. He lifted his wine glass, tapped his fingernail against its rim a few times, then set it back down on the quartz table.
It's not possible, Marlowe answered. She can't still be alive. She'd be beyond ancient. I hope so, Velis said. For her sake, by all the gods.
The sun sparkled off wavelets on the lake, and both men thought about the history of their clan, and where their great wealth had truly come from, and the great tragedy at its heart.
I hope so.
Chapter 24. Hyperspace. The Gaze Electric.
Marcion Rowe's flagship traveled through hyperspace, but in a way no other ship in the galaxy could. Its course was not set, moving from one access zone to another through a well-defined hyperspace lane. No, the Gaze Electric didn't move. It maneuvered. The massive ship plunged and rose, making impossibly tight turns, diving into tiny offshoots of the main road, and finding itself in an entirely new Ur-space. It followed routes that could not be seen and could not be repeated. Its path was charted by Mari Santeca, and Marcion Rowe let her have her head. She had complete control over the ship's navigation systems, and if the ride got a little bumpy sometimes, even terrifying. So what? These rides made Mari feel happy and good. They let her test her theories, work out new ideas. Piloting the Gaze Electric calmed her down, made her feel like she was in a good place, so that when Marcion asked her for specific paths, she was able to provide them without exhausting herself or getting frustrated. He looked through a viewport at the strange, unreal landscapes through which she was taking the ship. Like flying through a snowstorm made of flowers, built of bright green light. Beautiful and horrifying all at once. Traveling through hyperspace under ordinary circumstances was an entirely different experience. You entered the lane. You flew through the unchanging, swirling nothing for some set period, and then you exited back to real space. But Mari's flight was like that of a fast-winged insect, zipping from blossom to blossom, changing direction without bowing to considerations of inertia, acceleration, or deceleration. These abilities came at a cost, both in wear and tear and fuel. Though the Gaze Electric was specially equipped to handle them via a path engine of unique design. The very first, in fact, similar in appearance to those on all the other Nihil ships, but greatly enhanced in capabilities. The engines allowed the Nihil to translate the paths into actual navigational data that would be rejected by any conventional system as being impossible. They were the key to everything, now and in the future. Marcion had owned the huge vessel for a very long time, and his father before him, both of them haunting its empty spaces designed for thousands, now through time and treachery, inhabited by only a few. The Rose, father and son, had no homeworld. They left it behind long ago. The ship was as close as Marcion got, just as Mari Santeca was the nearest thing to family he had left. Marcion Rowe peered in at Mari, who lay in a sealed oblong pod with a clear front panel. Wires ran from it to power sources in the deck,
and large tanks of various medical chemicals bubbled nearby, their contents dripping into tubes running into the pod. The machine was essentially one large medical capsule, designed to keep Mari as healthy and comfortable as could be managed for a human who had been alive for well over a century. Mari had dialed into the particular focus she found while doing these runs, her eyes flickering, charting routes through the swirl of hyperspace that her mind was uniquely capable of seeing. No other being seemed able to do it, and no Navidroid came close. Droid brains could chart routes along already established paths, but what Mari did was nothing like that. Mari found the roads between the roads, via some mix of instinct and unconscious mathematical analysis that operated on a level she couldn't explain. Marchion had asked her, of course, many times, as had his father and his grandmother. If Mari Santeca's gift could be replicated, then there truly was no limit to what could be accomplished. Mari had tried, but it was like explaining why there were always more stars the farther you traveled, the deeper you looked. Some things just were, and could not be explained or duplicated. When Mari Santeca died, and that day could not be far off, despite the best medical technology in the galaxy being applied to extending her lifespan, the paths would die with her. And at that point, the thing that made the Nihil more than just another marauder gang carving out territory in the Outer Rim would vanish. Marchion pressed a control on the exterior of Mari's medical pod and spoke.
"Can you bring us back, Mari?"
Marchion Rose said. The old woman ignored him, and the gaze leapt again. Marchion braced himself against the shock without thinking. Some people could barely keep their feet when Mari Santeca took the ship on one of her little voyages, but he had been experiencing it since he was a child.
"Mari?"
he said again. No response. Hyperspace swirled outside the viewports, and Mari's eyes tracked it, seeing paths visible only to her. Marchion Rowe frowned. He pressed another control on the medical pod's console, and Mari's entire body tensed as a mild electric shock coursed through it. He wished she weren't making him do it. The woman was not robust, and he didn't know how many jolts she could take. Her doctor, a rotund Chadra fan named Uttersond, had once described Mari Santeca's heart as a paper lantern. But he didn't have time for her to be lost in her mind. He had plans and questions, and the Nihil needed paths, and the paths came from Marchion Rowe, but truly from this old woman, to whom he had tied his entire future. This woman he kept alive and pampered, and she just wanted to fly his ship halfway across the galaxy, instead of just... He pressed the button again, and Mari's body went rigid. Giving him...
Again!
What he...
Again!
Needed. Mari Santeca collapsed back against the cradle in her medical pod, and then her body trembled and shook. Her mouth gaped open, spittle shining at its corners, and her eyes rolled back in her head. An alarm began to sound, a low, insistent beep, which he knew would summon Dr. Uttersond. Marchion Rowe tapped another control, and the alarm ceased. He leaned over the medical pod, watching Mari Santeca endure her seizure. The pod went through its emergency procedures. Needles extended on actuator arms from its sides and slipped into the protruding veins on the woman's stick-thin arms as flat metal paddles slid beneath her robes to stimulate her heart.
"Maybe this is the end,"
he thought.
"Everything I've done, all those years of planning, it could be over right here, today.
The idea had a perverse appeal. Fascinated, he watched Mari Santeca's trembling, tiny body, wondering if his life was about to embark on, well, an entirely new path. His finger hovered over the alarm for Uttersand, and he didn't know what the idiot doctor could do, but perhaps something, and was pressing it even as Mari Santeca coughed, a sharp barking sound, and her seizures ended. Her eyes opened, and she looked around her in wonderment. They locked on Marcion, and she smiled, broad and kind, and open as a child.
Why, Marcion, hello. Did I lose myself again? I'm sorry. You know how I get when I take us traveling. There's just so much to see, you know.
Her index finger twitched on the control panel beneath her hand, and Marcion felt the gaze drop from hyperspace.
It's all right, Mari. Everything is just fine.
Mari swiveled the medical pod, taking it vertical, so instead of looking up at him, she could stare him right in the eye. Her mind was clouded by age, but her gaze was not. Her eyes were clear and focused, and she never seemed perturbed in the least by his own black orbs.
Well, that was a good one in any case. Found a new path between Fasana and Erber. Should reduce travel time by a third, maybe more. It'll make you a bundle.
Mari Santeca had been a hyperspace prospector since she was 6 years old. Something had happened to her as she traveled out in the interstellar wilderness with her family, and it had changed her. Changed her mind. Opened her up so she could see things no one else could. The paths. For some years, she had used that ability on behalf of her people and brought them wealth and renown. But that fame brought with it a price. Marcion Rowe's own family had taken Mari Santeca, stolen her. No reason to call it anything other than what it was. They had used her skill to find things they believed they needed back then. And then they had just kept her. Told her whatever stories were required to keep her happy and working. Handed her down from generation to generation until eventually she took up residence on the Gaze Electric. Mari Santeca seemed to believe she was still working as a prospector. Sometimes she thought